All right. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Dr. Toops.
How is everyone today?
Tired. Right.
Turn off my sound so I can hear you all. So I guess this is, what is this, our third week with online classes finishing up? Is that right?
Yep.
How are these going?
Better.
A lot better than my other classes.
Okay. I guess I take that as a good sign. Here, I'll put up our calendar as usual. How is the Zoom software working for you? It seems like we're getting pretty good attendance here, so, and I appreciate hearing from you all. There been any problems with Zoom?
No, really.
All right, so glad to hear the technological part is working okay. Like all your classes, we're figuring out a plan on the fly here, but I'm glad it's working out. And yeah, I think y'all are still getting a lot done in your lab assignments, and seeing a lot of y'all at help hours, and I think our lectures have gone pretty well. So we are now here on April the 3rd. So we're done talking about virtual memory, our like overview of virtual memory that you'll get deeper into in your OS class. Last week talked a bunch about caching and locality, which are kind of huge topics throughout so many levels, from the low level hardware stuff, caches are built into our hardware, to our system software, our operating system does tons of caching, our application software, our network stuff, caching's everywhere. So that'll come up whether you're into systems or you're into high level application stuff. We are turning back around to chapter 3 now. Chapter 3 is quite long, and we did sort of the first half earlier in the semester. And we'll be coming back, and that is partially to do our attack lab, which many folks find to be sort of a fun lab that I think you can get through pretty quickly if you've learned how to do GDB. If you didn't learn GDB very well with FunLab, then you're going to be a little slower getting started, but you'll get more good debugger practice, more good experience with, buffer overflows, of course, and computer security, but also just memory and pointers and function calls and all this stuff. And today I'm going to kind of start with the conceptual stuff for what's going to lead us into Attack Lab. And then next week we'll actually put out the lab. We'll give you the PDF of the lab write-up, and our TAs will show you how to get started, kind of as we did with Bomb Lab. So please don't miss that next week. Of course, we only have two classes next week, right? All right. Any questions or thoughts on where we're at?
Why do we only have two classes?
So a week from today, Friday the 10th is a holiday. There's no class that day. And I believe also classes have been canceled for April the 9th, which is a Thursday, which would apply to your other classes. So there'll be a short week next week. Okay. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, y'all, but I think that's correct.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. So another announcement, though. So since the Zoom stuff is working, it seems like it's been good. You've been able to, like, I assume you either have it saved somewhere or you just click on the Zoom link every time, right? We are going to make one little change to this starting next week. So there will be an access code. So this is just to make sure members of the public who are not in the class aren't disrupting us in any way. Not that we're keeping anything here a secret, but just to avoid any problems, there will be an access code. That code will be easy enough to remember. It will be the course number, which you all know, right? 2467. So don't panic when it asks you for an access code, and we're just It's just a minor little detail. We're trying to make it as fast as possible for you to get connected, since we were kind of quickly figuring out how to do this a few weeks ago. But yeah, we'll start doing that next week. We'll try and make a little note about it in this page here too, so it doesn't throw you off. So this isn't designed to make it difficult for you at all. This is really just to avoid any problems with automated programs messing with Zoom meetings or things like that. Sound okay? Not too scary, I hope. We'll update that, but just so you're not confused on Monday morning, there may be an extra, there's an extra code you got to put in or something like that. Should be pretty straightforward. So, let's, turn to our slides, which should be on the schedule now also. Let's see. Here we go. So, machine level procedures, back to chapter three. First, though, I do want to kind of summarize, I do like to sum these things up, looking at, the last few weeks of stuff. So we'll do a little wrap up of everything about processes. You certainly have heard me talk a lot about processes. So, let's wrap this up. Since our midterm break, midterm exam, we've really just been talking about all these different aspects of processes, what they are, why they're important, why they're crucial to our everything we like and take for granted about modern computers. So really, what we're getting down to is that each process has its own state. So what do I mean when I say state? Obviously, I'm not talking about the state of Louisiana or some sort of government entity. What is state?
You're talking about if it's terminated, stopped, or working?
Okay, yeah, so that's a good example. I mean, and that's in Shell Lab, that's exactly what state means, right?
Right.
So, sure, that's right. Although I guess I'm being a little more broad than that. But I'm glad you mentioned that, because yeah, that's a very specific state of running, stop, terminated, zombie, all that stuff. But I'm gonna broaden that a little bit. That is one type of state, but I guess I'm using state in the more broad sense that we tend to use in a lot of ways in computer science, whether something has a state or not. This includes whether it's running state, but also more broadly, each process having memory. There's some status, at any point in time, there's the stuff that's in memory, the stuff that the processor registers have, the stuff that the operating system keeps track of about that process. Everything that makes a process different from when you started it, there was some initial state of, whatever the data was, and, maybe a bunch of things are initialized to zero or something like that. And then later on in the program, it reads in some data. So now there's some new state, there's a new program counter, there's some data read into memory, some file descriptors opened. Everything the program does as it, makes progress through time is changing its state. Have you heard the term finite state machine?
Yeah, but I don't know what that is.
In another class, perhaps?
In Java, yeah.
Oh, yeah? I didn't know that came up in the Java class, but I would think it would come up in your algorithms class. I don't know if any of y'all have taken that yet, or maybe you're in it now.
Yeah, we're building one in theory of comp right now.
Theory of computation. There you go. Yeah. Okay, cool. I definitely knew it was in some of those other classes. So you kind of know what state means in that sense, right? Some point in the operation of this software or this machine, right? What's the example they like to give you when they first tell you about a finite state machine? What's a real world example?
Like the doors, when you walk on the pad and it opens the door, and then you have multiple states. So if someone's standing on the front of the pad and the back of the pad, it stays open. If no one's on either one, it's closed. So there's multiple reasons why it would be closed, or multiple would be open, and those are your different states. I mean, the two states are open and closed, I guess, and you have different reasons why they'd be open or closed.
Sure, because it could be, oh yeah, like you said, because it's someone on one side or open on the other side. So that's cool, because that's like, that's a physical thing in the math building that many of you probably, for you attend. Physically very close to that in the math building, which is the vending machines, right? Have you heard this as a finite state machine?
No.
Well, you've all probably used a vending machine for a drink or a snack, right? So that's a thing where like, you know, it's got like a start state, but then there's a like, you've inserted one quarter and that's like, that's not enough to buy a drink. But let's say a drink was 50 cents. Then when you've inserted the second quarter, now it's in a state where if you press a button, it'll do something, you know. But anyways, finite states in that there's really only so many different combinations of whether you've put money in or not, or whether you've pressed a button or not. That can, you know, add up to either it gives you a drink or it doesn't give you a drink. Anyway, the vending machine was the example I heard. So anyway, so back to state. That's the sort of broader idea of state, which is just that, what, you know, whether it's a vending machine or a door or a piece of software, the things that decide, you know, there's a difference between putting in the first quarter and the second quarter, or there's a difference between, in the door case, you're either on, that's almost binary, but, any case, so let's talk about process state in the general sense. So the state has implications. There's the control flow. So this is a pretty crucial part of the state. You know, where are we at the beginning of the program? Are we in some, you know, in the middle of some loop? What is the program? What is it just done? What is it about to do? So, of course, we've talked about context switching. That's really switching. That first definition of state that y'all first mentioned, of, you know, running or waiting or whatever. So that's the context switching. Signals interrupt the control flow by, you know, moving the program counter over to a signal handler, the instruction pointer. So signals alter control flow, and then system calls are, you know, when your program calls fork or open or even printing something, it's saying, okay, this is something the operating system has to do. It's like, unschedule me and go do this thing I've asked you to do. And of course, we check the result of that system call. So we see, well, did it work and can we proceed? Did that open actually work? Because we can't actually operate on that file until it's been opened. Anyway, so that's all, wait, you know, control flow are all forms of state for the process. And then the CPU state, more specifically, you know, each process has a set of registers. Of course, that instruction pointer, which is where control flow is, but also the stack pointer, the values of these, you know, computations that may be like in progress using the various registers to finish computing something. And of course, we've seen with CPU state that context switching sets a different CPU state for all these processes, so that, you know, one process has this REX register and the other process has a different REX register, and that can get set and restored by the OS during context switch. And the memory state, so all the stuff in this address space, we've talked about virtual memory, so each process has its own space of addresses that, and may even overlap with some other process. But those are virtual addresses, so the physical addresses are still separate and processes have their own memory. Virtual memory provides protection such that processes don't mess up each other's memory. Of course, caching is going to be impacted by, you know, what memory has been read recently and what will be in the cache. And even file descriptors are stored in memory state, which is like what files have been opened and what have not. So all bits of state in processes that we've talked about, and these are all, you know, each process is independent with its state, but they share one physical system. So that's kind of the big accomplishment of processes. And even though you might think, well, what does opening files have to do with caching, or what does opening files have to do with scheduling and context switching? Well, all of these things kind of come together to make the full picture of what a process is. And of course, a process is, you know, the only way you run a program. So so all of this, you know, all of our programs are all tied up in all this stuff. And the abstractions of the process and the virtual memory system kind of make all this possible. So, they really do. In all the ways we've talked about, we've really kind of touched on them on a fairly broad level. And I think as you go deeper into like the 4,000 level systems classes, you'll get, you know, some more on this. I guess also maybe in computer organization, which is not 4,000, but okay. So that's my way of kind of tying together everything from, you know, chapter 8, of course, which you did throughout, used a lot during Shell Lab, but also chapter 10 with file descriptors, and 6 and 9 with caching and virtual memory. So all of this is to give you insight into the way systems work, since, you know, you'll, if you're gonna understand why your programs work or don't work or work well or perform well, you need to know stuff about the system that runs your programs. And, you know, that's just if you're only caring about application programs. If you're actually making systems and libraries, you definitely need this insight. The next few slides I have for you sort of reference an email I got from one of our colleagues at UNO, Dr. Suma, who I think most of you have had a class from, right? So a couple semesters ago, in the middle of the semester, he sent me this email about a systems thing. He's like, oh, your class might be interested in this. And I was like, that's funny. This is very apropos to what we were just in the middle of. And it has to do with all this process stuff. So the link was all about how processes and systems are sort of notorious. You know, I kind of got done talking about why it's important and crucial and why we should love processes. But also there's a certain part of this that has kind of been difficult, and it kind of came back to the link he sent me was from this talk entitled "You Are Not Expected to Understand This, But You Will." And that first part in blue is referencing what they're calling the most notorious source code comment of the Unix operating system. So this thing, "You are not expected to understand this," occurs in a particularly kind of difficult to read bit of code dealing with processes. But anyway, this talk ends up being I think pretty cool in that it touches on all these things we talk about. And his kind of takeaway point here is that while it seems kind of mysterious and magical, you know, it can be understood. And I think the ideas that we've been giving you should hopefully make this clear. And kind of the example, incidentally, of the source code comment looks like this. And it's in this part of code that's talking all about processes, memory stack, swapping, virtual memory, and restoring flags and registers. And, you know, in fact, if you had never done C before, and I hope now you at least have some experience that you can read like the ampersand, there's actually a bitwise and there, and there's a pointer dereference here, and a complement operator. And so these are all, you know, this is kind of what operating system source code looks like. It really does use all of this stuff. So, you know, the things we've been talking about in systems are just kind of the basics necessary if you were to like read the source code of an operating system. But also this comment is just kind of been, people think it's kind of funny to write, "You're not expected to understand this," in some source code. And it wasn't meant to say you're not going to get it as much as just that this is, yes, we know this is tough. And, you know, in fact, some people have made a t-shirt out of it, and you can see the speaker actually wearing the "You Are Not Expected to Understand This" t-shirt. But yeah, what it comes down to is all these abstractions of processes come together to make this thing that looks pretty pretty crazy in source code actually work out. So anyhow, I'd love to go through all this stuff, but I'll leave it to Arun Thomas, who gives us in a great talk. It's from a conference that I hope you're all excited about, because it's called Systems We Love, which should be perfect for all of you system students. So you can check it out. Dr. Suma's link is here. You can click on it on the slides later on if you want to. Unix's most notorious source code comment. I believe that your systems experience so far should at least give you the, you know, vocabulary and the building blocks to figure this sort of stuff out. You know, please check that out and let me know. You know, are you prepared to take on these big systems topics? I hope so. you know, of course, system performance is the other thing that we talked a lot about with all of this stuff that we're summing up now, from the processor, the memory, the disk, the network, all these things have huge gaps in speed, but we're able to make the most of it, even though there's these huge differences between them, and the gaps actually get bigger over time. But caching addresses these and lets us utilize fast CPUs, and lets us, even when our network's slow, we have disk caching and we have memory caching to make our disks run faster. All of it comes down to locality, which you've gotten some ideas. We've given you some examples of loops and dealing with spatial and temporal locality, and the nice little metaphor of the library and the bookshelf at home, which hopefully you will, this idea of locality will stick with you from that experience. Does it all tie together and make sense now? Or at least hopefully come together in some meaningful way that I hope sticks with you. So processes, we're done with processes. Procedures is the next P word I have for us to utilize a lot. What do you think of this when I say to you, we're going to talk about procedures? What do you think I'm talking about? What are you expecting?
Like a certain way to do things?
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty fair. I mean, that's kind of general, but yeah. But, as a specific thing in a computer program, what is a procedure? It turns out it's something that I think you are familiar with. You're probably just not used to calling it this. Procedure is a broad term for a thing that has many names, which is, a way of doing things, even like a recipe, which is really what our source code is. But, this is something that can get called and reused many times. In C, we call these functions. Of course, you would be accustomed to in Java calling these methods, right? Usually I have a lot of students come here from learning Java and they're used to saying, methods, the things that have the parentheses after them that are, bits of code that get called and over and over again. We don't use the term method in C, even though it's a very similar idea. And I'm not mad when I hear you say I'm working on my eval method. But to be totally precise about it, method refers to method is always a part of an object or a part of a class. Whereas a function is sort of stands on its own. So of course we don't have classes and objects in regular old C. So, but functions are a type of procedures, methods a type of procedures. There's even some, old programming language just call this procedures in general. So, we are talking about something that you have experience with, whether you've called it a method or a function. we're going to be using C examples here and talking a lot about functions, but the same idea applies to your methods in Java. So procedures, these kind of have some broad things that they do, and I think you've utilized all these whether you've thought about it this way or not. So in this very general example, we have P, and that thing named P, this function, capital P at the top. And we're calling this very general, dot, dot, dot. There's some parameter there. The big black dots represent some code that do some stuff. We're not really concerned with what. But at some point during P, there is a function called capital Q here. And that is a separate function further down the code. We see int capital Q with some integer parameter I. P is calling Q in this example. We're not paying too much attention to what exactly it does with that integer. Again, you've all written functions or you've written methods that call each other things like this. So, what are procedures really accomplishing? Well, okay, yeah. So we're reusing, you can call Q over and over again without having to like write that code every single time. Sure, that's probably like the first reason why you think of writing these. But using kind of all the systems terms we've worked with so far, let's just say, okay, so we've got we're dealing with control, we're dealing with data, we're dealing with memory. So let's look at control flow. As this C code will be compiled to assembly, and they'll just be this series of instructions. And you know that the instruction pointer will sort of, you know, move in a straight line down through all those instructions until it reaches a call here, a call instruction, which is how this thing Q is called. So at that point, the procedure call or the function call changes the control flow. So instead of just going straight to the next line, in this case, you know, Y equals Q of X. So before that print on the next line happens, all the stuff in Q has to happen. So that means the instruction pointer changes. And that's what we have for this red arrow here. So, you know, when this call is invoked, even before the result is saved in Y, all of this code down here in Q has to run. So, you know, of course, you've done this before. You've understood this already. And also, after all this stuff in Q happens, this return statement means that the control flow will now return back, not actually to the print yet, but really just to the writing the result into Y. And in fact, you know, it would be possible to have, you could have several different, you know, function calls. That Y could be like the sum of a bunch of function calls or something like that. So all of the function calls would have to happen on that previous line before you move on to the next one. So anyhow, this thing Y is going to hold, you know, this assignment to the thing Y is going to happen next, and then the print statement. So the control flow goes to the beginning of the function when it's called, and then the return puts it right back where it left off. And again, you've written code, you've done all this, so this you know, but we're just putting it in the terms of control flow. Sound good so far? Okay, we talked about control. What about the data? So, well, there is some there's some data involved here. There's input to this function Q, and there's output from Q. The input is this parameter X. So whatever X is within P is the input to Q. Now, you'll see that within Q, the parameter is actually called I. So that's okay in a different, in P's, in the scope of P, X is just, you know, some value, I guess, an integer, you know, could be 17. And then when Q is called, this 17 is substituted in for I, which you see then gets multiplied by 3, and then some other stuff happens. So, you know, that 17 was input, although it does have a different name in the scope of Q. And then when Q returns, not only does the control go back up into P, but also some data does, some result. And Q was defined as having return type int up at the top to the left of the Q. And so therefore, some values return. In this case, it's some member of an array, but there's some int gets pulled out and returned as the return value of Q, which then gets stored in Y. So that's the red arrow returning that. So there's a number input to Q and a number output from Q. So that is the way data is passed in and out of functions using parameters. And you know, this is actually built into the hardware because there's a register, really built into the calling convention, because we know there's a register where that return value goes, and there's a register where parameters go from the calling convention. All right. Well, what else? There's a few other things that make procedures work. So there is memory management involved here. So this thing Q, every time it runs, gets some I's input, but it's also going to have T and V declared within it. Those are local variables within the scope of this particular invocation of Q. So if Q is invoked later, there'd be a different T and a different V created. So T and V are created when and allocated. There's actual bytes in memory representing, you know, where these things are stored. When Q is called, that space gets allocated and then they can be used. And when Q returns, the space for storing T and V and anything local to the scope of Q would be deallocated. It would go away. It could get, you know, get reused by whatever thing gets called next. So the local variables within Q are temporary in scope and kind of appear and disappear as the function is called and when it returns. So is this consistent with what you've done with functions and methods? So, you know, assembly instructions, machine instructions here are what makes all of this work. So I mentioned the calling convention, and also we're going to talk more about the stack memory now when we're talking about local variables and also how control passing control works. But passing data deals with the calling convention as well, all using registers and instructions. And in x86-64, it says, well, uses only those mechanisms required. So the idea here is x86-64 is designed to be to perform well, as you know, speed was the huge consideration that drove the design. So you know, they're going to try and do this as quickly as possible. They're not going to use extra registers if they're not necessary, and not going to do extra pushes and pops if they're not necessary. So there's some older ways that procedure calls were done that maybe did some unnecessary stuff or things that might have slowed things down. And x86-64 says, well, we're going to do this the fastest way possible and skip anything unnecessary. So I'll kind of point some of those out later on. So those are the basic mechanisms, again, that I think you know about, but we've kind of defined a little more precisely here. Any thoughts on this? So now we're going to talk a little bit more about this stack memory. So you've probably, I think you've seen this a little bit in assembly, maybe even when we're using GDB, there's some stack section that we probably said we're going to get into more later in the semester. So you've seen this, but maybe haven't dug into it too much. So what is this? Well, some region of memory. We have, of course, this huge memory space of virtual direct memory, and this is just arbitrarily chosen that in the same way that, you know, if we remember, we had that diagram before where the code section is always around hexadecimal 400000. There's a separate section for stack memory. These are virtual addresses, so this means that the operating system and the NMU can put those in physical memory wherever they need to go. But the virtual addresses are kind of by convention in certain locations. So memory always treated as this array of bytes with an address for each byte. This is the policy decision, or really the convention, is to put stack at some higher addresses than code. Why do we call this stack? Well, it's a, you know, that's the term we use for a certain type of, really, a data structure. And that is just a thing that, you know, grows in one direction as things are added and things are removed in the opposite order. The basic operations of the stack are the push and the pop, which I believe you're familiar with. So, but in this case, if we had some stack pointer at some location, that location, the stack pointer, is where when something is pushed, it goes at that location. RSP is some memory address, and so some data that's pushed ends up down there. Where did my push go? My push is coming up. So kind of arbitrary. It doesn't really matter what you call top and bottom, but in x86-64, a stack, as it grows, the addresses get lower. You would think that's sort of annoying. Why I call it the top. Well, really the initial definition of a stack is this thing, you know, imagine, I think some of you are used to a stack of plates, or I've always preferred the metaphor of the pancakes, but like there's a thing, and if that thing's on top, you can remove it. But if there's another thing like a plate or pancake or whatever on top, you can only take the top one. You can't really slide anything out from underneath. So you only have access to one thing at a time. So when there's a push, this thing gets added at the bottom. And that is now the top of the stack. And the thing that was at the top of the stack before is like, you know, buried one level lower now. And then a pop operation would remove it, and now we're back to where we were before that push. So we have these assembly instructions, push and pop. The textbook will call it push Q and pop Q because the AT&T assembly puts a little suffix denoting the like size of the thing being pushed. In any case, these are operating on registers, which is to say 8-byte registers, 64-bit registers on our modern systems. So push operation changes the stack pointer by 8 bytes, and then it writes 8 bytes at the location of the stack pointer. So that is the push, adding the stuff down at the bottom, and then the pop, removing it and adding 8 to RSP to move it back up to where it was before. So push and a pop kind of do the opposite. Push takes register, puts it in memory, changes the stack pointer accordingly. Pop takes something out of the register, out of the memory into the register, and moves the stack pointer back up. So is this how you've seen push and pop used before? Maybe in assembly.
Yeah.
So we have some let's just look at the calling convention, specifically how it looks in assembly. So and again, you know, you're going to be jumping back into GDB next week and looking at assembly instructions. They're, you know, coming from a C program that was compiled, and once again you'll just be looking at the assembly that the compiler generated. So we'll show you some C code and how it got compiled into assembly. So we have two functions on the left in C, multstore in yellow and multto in green. And you'll see multstore calls multto. So this is sort of following the, you know, P and Q analogy of the caller and callee, we will call them. So multstore is going to run first. Of course, all of these instructions have addresses. So when the instruction pointer or program counter is at 400540, the next instruction is a push. So push RBX, the value of that register goes on stack memory, and stack pointer changes by 8 bytes. Okay. Now we have a move instruction of moving. Now in AT&T assembly, the operands are the other direction. So this is RDX being stored into RBX. You'll read it the other way, and when you change GDB over to Intel assembly. And then a call to mult2. So why move? Well, the destination address is this thing, the third parameter. RDX is the third parameter, mult2. So, but really what we care about is at the point of this call, what's going to happen? Well, the instruction pointer, instead of going on to 549, it's going to go to 400550. So that's the you know, control flow is going to change because of the call instruction. And then also there's a calling convention that's going to move some data over. So this is all just showing you all the stuff we were talking about in the more general sense of P and Q. And then in this case, the called function mult2 really just does a move and a multiply. And you see it tries to do this with as few instructions as possible. So you know, in old x86, the parameters would have been pushed before the call and then popped after the call. But that's unnecessarily slow if you can do this in registers only. And so this is how, so this has been implemented only with registers for maximum speed. So we'll kind of diagram this some more, but that's the overview. So the memory stack is really what makes this call and return work. So in order to see how call and return really work, we have to pay attention to stack memory. The definition of this call is a call instruction followed by some label. You know, we give it the name of a function, although really when it's compiled, that just becomes an address. The names are for our benefit, but the computer will just treat them as locations. So call some position in memory that does two things. Call some memory address and jump to some memory address. You know, an unconditional jump would just change the instruction pointer to the location to jump to. What's the difference with call? Well, call, you know, implies that you're going to return after it's done, whereas jump is just sort of a one-way thing. So a call does include a jump, but more importantly, before that jump, it's going to do a push. So I always say this, and this is kind of one of those things that you can hear me repeat a lot the same way. It's like, oh, fork, called once, returned twice. You heard that a bunch of times, right? Well, the big takeaway we really need to do all the things, a push and a jump, push and a jump. What push what? Well, a return address. In other words, this call implies that there's, you know, the code's going to return there after that procedure call is done. So we have to actually say where to return to. That where to return to is called the return address. So the return address is pushed as a part of a call. And then there's a jump to where that called function will actually be and where the instruction pointer will go and execute. So the return address, more specifically, is the address of the instruction right after the call. So the thing that should run as soon as that called thing is done. So we'll look at that in the example. But the other big thing that we'll drill into here is that the return instruction also does two things, and it's essentially the opposite or the inverse of the call. So a return does two things, a pop and a jump back. Well, the pop and jump is to wherever the thing is that got popped. So when our program calls a function expecting to return, that the only way that that's possible is using stack memory to store that return location. Otherwise, the computer doesn't have anywhere else to, you know, store something like where should a return go to after this function call is done. The only way it has to do that is to look into memory. Otherwise, there's no method. There's no way to do this. So again, let's illustrate some more with our example code. Again, mult store reaches this line where there's a call instruction. So we'll just have some example values here. So again, imagine this in GDB, and RIP says this. That's the next thing that's going to happen if you hit next instruction, or really in this case, SI for step instruction, because we want to actually step into mult2 and see each of those instructions also. So RSP at the moment, we haven't done this call yet, but RSP, we're putting a hexadecimal value 120. Of course, that's way too low. We're just making something small to put on the slide. This is really going to be some larger hexadecimal value. But yeah, we'll call it 120 just to, so we can get through this a little quicker. But you see, we treat that as a pointer, as an address. So the register holds some address in it, but that address itself and the other things near it all contain, you know, some data. We're kind of putting dot, dot, dot. It's whatever mult store was doing before we got to this point. But when it comes time to make this call instruction, two things are going to happen. You remember them yet? I got to repeat them a few more times. A push and a jump. So the push is what? The return address. So where do we want to return to when mult2 is finished? Well, 400549, that's the move right after the call. So that's where the return address should be. So 400549, that's what's going to get pushed. And then there's going to be a jump. Well, what does a jump really do? Jump just changes the instruction pointer. 400550. That's what the call is trying to call. So that's what the jump will do. So two things will happen. We'll see a push, and I'll just move that along. So now you see the push, right? So 400550. Of course, the push has also changed RSP. Now the stack pointer is at 118 instead of 120. And then, of course, also finally, the instruction pointer has changed to 400550. In other words, it jumped from 5-4-0. Before it was like this, 544 went to 5-4-5-5-0, but 549 got pushed onto the stack. Of course, these are all fairly small functions, so these numbers are pretty close to each other, but they could be far apart. So that is our call instruction kind of drawn out for you. Again, two things, push the return address and then do the jump. What do you think? Okay, cool. And I see y'all are answering me on the chat, but I just don't have that window in front of me, so it's a little hard to see. I don't know why it doesn't show me that, but okay, cool. So finally, we can just again illustrate the return, which again does two things, the kind of the opposite things. So we get down to the return. Well, what's going to happen? The instruction pointer has, you know, without any calls or jumps, it's just moving right along through those instructions till it reaches 400557. So that is a return instruction. So that does two things. First, a pop. Well, pop what? Depends where RSP is. Well, RSP is here at 118, so it's going to pop 400549. So what are we going to do with 400549? Yeah, so we're going to jump there, and really what jump means is stick it in the instruction pointer. So 400549 is going to be the new instruction pointer, but also RSP changes back to 120. So our stack point is right back where it was before the call. The instruction point right after the call. You know, we haven't even really worried much about what MUL2 did, but we're just talking about control flow. The data is going to get passed through REX as the return value, as you've seen. So that is the control flow from a call and a return. So that's the kind of, well, one of the most important parts of our procedure call. We'll also talk more about data and how that works. But this happens every time there's a call instruction and every time there's a return instruction. We're going to talk more about how this works. You know, of course, recursive functions do tons of calls and tons of returns. This is happening constantly throughout your programs. So, and it's also at the key to how you can attack programs like in Attack Lab. Of course, we'll get to that also. But first, we want to kind of define how things work in the normal case. So, but knowing how this works well, not only helps you with like debugging and program performance, but also has big security implications. So, what do you think?
I have a quick question.
Yes, please go for it.
So, I know the instruction pointer is just pointing to like pretty much what line is being like executed. So then what's the stack pointer, like what's that really referencing, like the hexadecimal value, what's that representing?
Well, it's a memory address. So here, and again, 120 is kind of artificially small. We'll see in, you know, in GDB you'll actually see some big number, it'll be like 7FFF something, but it's really just an address. Let me see, I pressed the wrong thing. It's really just an address in memory, and I guess in the general sense it's gonna you know, well, I have a better diagram from the virtual memory slides, but you know, there's some region of memory down below where code is located. There's some other memory addresses up here where stack is located. And these are, you know, again, all these bytes of memory have addresses. So RSP is really just the very edge of the stack, really, which they'll call top, even though it's a low address. But the very edge of the stack is the address of that very edge of the stack is what's in the RSP register. So it is a little harder to follow the instruction pointer, so I'm glad you asked. You know, practice will help clarify this. You know, we'll have many more examples. So keep thinking about that. And you'll when you're done with the TAC lab, you'll have a lot of firsthand hands-on experience with this. Anyway, I'll take more questions, but otherwise we'll leave it there and come back next week with a bunch of TAC lab stuff, and it'll be fun, y'all. So stick with it. Don't forget the secret access code for lectures starting next week. Secret 2467, our course number. Pretty easy, right? Anyway, thanks for your questions and thoughts, and good seeing you all during the various Zoom meetings this week. And have a good weekend.